The following podcast is a production of Institutional Real Estate Incorporated. For the most comprehensive industry news and information, visit our website at irei.com and sign up for our free daily news alerts.
Let's talk first about your decision to start Beacon Point Advisors. What was behind the decision, Shannon?
Sure. So I was in grad school at UCLA. My second year of grad school, I was working full-time for an investment advisory firm, and I was in an entrepreneurship class and wrote a piece, which sits under my desk, which I got a B on, about starting this company. And it was really with the eye towards, at the time, there was no investment advisory firm that I knew of that had a holistic, unconflicted approach to advice. So I had been working for an investment advisory firm who managed large cap growth portfolios. A client would come in and, you know, we were compelled to say, yes, we can help you with everything, but we couldn't help them with everything, right? You know, we were a single sleeve of their portfolio and we had product. So we didn't know, you know, I couldn't say, hey, we're going to fire ourselves at this point, or you're better off sued with a manager down the street. So it was more of a recognition that something was missing in the industry. My father had started a firm, Canterbury Consulting, in the 80s, late 80s, really working with institutional investors. And a partner of mine at my prior firm that I was working, he was deciding to leave, so we decided we were going to start this company together. And I said, hey, let's see if we can get my dad involved. And my dad was, it just happened to be the right timing, and he was willing to jump on board too. And we went in as equal partners in the firm, all came up with the same amount of money and put it to work.
So you co-founded the firm with how many people?
There were three of us that founded the firm originally.
And you're counting your father as one of them then?
Correct.
Okay, so you...
We bought that other partner out in 2005, so pretty early on.
Okay, so it's really you and your dad at this point that are in charge of the owners of the firm.
Well, no, so it'd probably be helpful to explain our business model, then I can explain the partners. We have seven other partners here in our Newport Beach office that own a piece of the firm. And then when we make acquisitions of firms in other areas, so Philadelphia, Boston, Texas, San Jose, those are also partner offices. So we own basically half of that business. The other partners own the other half of that business, the partners that are running that business. So today I have really 26 partners.
And so the number of offices that you brought into the fold have been how many? 23?
We have 11 outside offices. We've got the Inland Empire, San Jose, Santa Barbara, Newport Beach, Arizona, Dallas, Boston, and Philadelphia. So that's nine.
And where are you in Arizona? Are you in Phoenix?
We're in Scottsdale.
Scottsdale. And headquarters is Newport Beach. Okay.
Correct.
You were with Roxbury Capital Management, is that right, before you made the decision to start the firm?
I was.
And it says here in your bio that you oversaw socially responsible in investments for several years over there. Can you talk a little bit about SRI and both the kind of work you were doing at the time with socially responsible investments and how you have seen it change over the years?
Yeah, it's interesting. So we ran a socially responsible portfolio. One of our strategies, you know, it's an offshoot of the strategy, the main strategy that we were running at Roxbury, the large cap growth strategy. So we ran a social responsible piece of that portfolio, or the overlay basically on that portfolio. And it's interesting, we had a lot of requests at the time to run socially responsible. We don't see that much anymore. We do get clients who want socially responsible, or they have, you know, certain restrictions they'd like on their portfolio. But I think that's changed quite a bit over the last 10 to 15 years. Of course, we have, you know, religious institutions that have certain, you know, governance. They want to, you know, abide by the bishop's rules. But we don't really see it too much on the private client side.
That's interesting. That's unusual, it seems. I just hear so much about the demand for impact investing or socially responsible investing.
If we do see that, I should correct myself there. We don't see it, like I said, we're not seeing it as much on the private client side, but we are definitely seeing that on the institutional side, especially with the school systems.
Okay. So,
and we, you know, the way our approach works, I don't know how much you know about the firm overall, but you probably obviously read our website, but the way that we work is we go out, and we've got a research team that is going out and looking for what we believe to be the best-in-class investment managers within each asset class. So, you know, for impact investing, we have managers within that sleeve that we're looking for to fulfill client needs.
So you're in graduate school when you write the business plan for Beacon Point. Tell me, what were some of the highlights of the business plan? What were some of the major components of that plan?
Well, I think the biggest component was it not being associated with any product. So we're everywhere we looked, it was, you know, okay, there was, and I don't necessarily want me to quote, there were the major brokerage houses on, you know, that had, you know, obviously their product and client portfolios. And if they weren't a major brokerage house, they had a broker-dealer. And what we were seeing is that, gosh, you know, on the broker-dealer side, if you're an investment advisory firm, you have a broker-dealer, again, you're conflicted in that investment managers are trading through your platform.
Yeah, I understand.
And at what point do you let those managers go when they're paying you more for the trading than they're paying you for, you know, managing those client assets?
How did you decide on a name? Why Beacon Point?
You know, we actually, nothing really exciting. We actually had a marketing firm help us select the name. And we just thought it represented kind of who we were. We were looking to help clients, you know, direct clients' investments.
Tell me how the firm succeeded. I mean, there's a lot of, you know, RIAs out there that just kind of limp along. It's probably not that big a deal just to keep the door open and the shingle hanging on the wall. Obviously, you've gone far beyond that. What was the key, or how did you make Beacon Point successful?
I think I do believe a lot of it was luck and hiring the right people that all had the vision and mission to help clients. We didn't start this firm thinking we were going to have, you know, offices across the country, you know, 130 employees. We started the firm thinking there's a better way to help clients.
Tell us what form did luck take?
I think being in the market at the right time. Right, coming out of 2002, you know, we had a pretty decent market going into 2002, 2003. So I think the market timing was right. I think people were starting to look at, am I in the right place for my investments? Because we have a bias towards asset protection, meaning we're looking for investment managers to protect on the downside. When clients were looking for protection of their wealth, I think they saw that as a positive of the organization.
Tell us about the biggest surprise. You obviously were in the business. You must have moved into this figuring you knew pretty much what to expect, but there were probably some surprises along the way. Is there any surprise that really stood out for you or that kind of shocked you?
Let me think about that. I would say, obviously, 2008, it was a surprise to many. I think I was pleasantly surprised coming out of 2008. Our clients fared very well during that period, and pleasantly surprised that was our fastest growth of the organization coming out of 2008. What I guess shouldn't surprise me, but continually surprised me, is that investors' memories are very short-term.
Mm,
you know, so it's a reminder of you know, reminding clients what, you know, what the market looks like during volatile periods. And you get a period, you know, like last year where we're not have, we don't have a lot of volatility, that volatility will be back. There will be reversion to the mean. It's just, you know, a constant reminder to clients. The other thing is, when we started the company, we were really an investment firm, right? Because we came out of the institutional arena. My father had been working primarily with large foundations and endowments. So our basis for our research, our basis for investments, for asset allocation, for everything came really from that institutional model. So you get the private clients were benefiting from being able to have this platform that were really held to an institutional standard, just a different standard of investing, which I think was extremely beneficial for the private client.
Now, is that something your father brought to the table?
That's correct. That was his expertise, and you know, he was one of the original, I think, founders of institutional consulting back in the late or mid, probably early 70s, early to mid 70s at Kidder Peabody.
So you write a business plan. It's very typical for business plans to change form along the way, oftentimes multiple times. How has your business, how is it different today than what you originally envisioned?
I would say the biggest piece that's different is when we started the firm, as I said, we were more of an investment firm. And what we still do investments, we still do investments well, and that's a significant focus of the organization. But I would say the level of financial planning when we started the firm with where we are today is vastly different. So when we work today with a client, I mean, we're really diving deep into all aspects of their financial life, you know, and then they have access to a portal where they can see absolutely every part of their financial picture, and we can push or pull levers based on what they're trying to accomplish with their financial life. Versus early on in the firm, you know, writing an asset allocation, doing investment manager selection, and, you know, really just looking at upside, downside, as well as, you know, how can this portfolio perform over a given time horizon, versus being able to pull different levers of a client's overall wealth to determine what's the most appropriate investment for various vehicles within their total portfolio.
So the distinction you're making then as an investment house or investment firm would simply be making the investments. What you're doing at Beacon Point is broader than that. You're doing actual planning, putting together plans.
Full service financial planning, absolutely.
Okay, and you're making the investments on their behalf as well.
Correct.
Okay, so.
Correct. And I really do believe going forward that's going to continue to be where the added value is for a client portfolio. It's fully understanding the financial planning side for a private client. And even, frankly, for an institution, right, doing the planning to make sure that we're strategically helping with their planning as they look to implement various projects within their organization and to be able to give back to the community in ways that they would like to with those assets.
So, you know, I noticed, let me ask you this question. How are you? Do you consider yourself a competitive person?
Yes, I do.
Because I noticed you are a collegiate volleyball player. Anybody who's involved in athletics is usually pretty, especially at a collegiate level or beyond that, is usually quite competitive. So tell us.
I'm self-competitive, so I don't necessarily. I run marathons and I like to do that kind of thing, and I'm competitive with myself, right? I'm not competitive with the person running next to me.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, when I played volleyball, I was competitive against the team across the net. You know, in our business, you know, it's not that I'm looking to compete with my competitor that's down the street. It's more, can we be doing the best thing we can be doing here for our clients?
So, how tall are you, if you don't mind my asking? Some volleyball players are quite tall, and some not so much.
I'm 5'5".
5'5". Okay, so you're more Misty May than Kerry Walsh, as far as that goes.
I'm definitely on the shorter side.
And you played, it was indoor hard court volleyball.
Exactly. Yeah, I played for UC Irvine.
UC Irvine. And what was your shot? What was your expertise? What was the thing you did better than
started, so I was a starter, but I played back row. So basically what today's libero position is, it was my position.
Okay. And now you still sit on the UCI Athletic Fund board.
I'm currently actually not sitting on that right now.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Recently have moved off that. But yes, I mean, wait, I served on that. I coached my kids in soccer. I've been very involved in my kids' athletics and in terms of, you know, helping and serving on boards for them. So I love, the reason why I didn't get much sleep last night, I was at a Clippers-Kings game up in Sacramento last night. So I do like sports.
Oh, okay. Who won that game?
The Clippers.
No, not surprising.
Okay. Yeah, although, you know what? It was close.
Well, I was in Sacramento, so that always helps with the hometown crowd.
Exactly.
So let me ask you this. What about, you went to UC Irvine. What did you study? What was your undergraduate degree in?
My undergraduate degree was, my major was in social sciences, which seems a little bit peculiar, but at the time, actually I think it's still the case, but they didn't have a finance major. So I did a investment or a management minor and social science major. And I was able to take, you know, econ classes and all the classes underneath the social science major.
So did you know when you were an undergrad that you wanted to get in the financial services business?
You know, no, I did not. I did an internship with Smith Barney during college. I also was working at a restaurant that ended up growing into a multiple chain restaurant. So I ended up helping them open a couple of their stores. They ended up, after I had left, many years after, they sold that company to Cisco. But during that time, I realized that, I think I'd been there for a couple of years after college, I realized that was not the path I wanted to take. I called my father and I said, look, I think I want to be in the investment management space. I was staying with a friend up in the Bay Area, and I said, just tell me, who do you think is the best? Who's the best in the space? Who would you talk to if you were going to work today? And he gave me a handful of names, and Roxbury was kind enough to say, sure, you can come in and intern for us. We don't have a job for you. I said, great, I'll do whatever it takes. So I drove 55 miles each way for an internship and ended up, they still didn't really have a job for me when the internship was over, but I told them I wasn't leaving. I want to stay here. I want to work here. And ended up being able to, you know, learn a ton about the business. Worked very early mornings, stayed late, learned every aspect of that business I could learn. And I ended up leaving there as a senior managing director. So it paid off by putting the time in.
So they let you stay. They let you do an unpaid internship. Is that?
It was a paid internship. They ended up hiring me because I wouldn't leave.
Okay, so they saw that you really you obviously impressed upon them how much you really wanted to be with the firm. But what attracted you to the business anyway? Why? What was the big draw to you? Why is it such an attractive profession for you?
I think for me, I love serving others. And to be able to serve others through their investments and help them achieve what their happily ever after looks like through their investments is very gratifying.
So where does your MBA come in at this point? You were already working at Rock Spirit Capital, is that right, when you went for your MBA?
That's correct.
And your MBA had an emphasis in marketing or finance?
Finance.
Okay. You mentioned your dad, and he obviously played a central role in your career. Can you elaborate on that a little bit more, kind of give us maybe some anecdotes or just generally how your dad really helped form your personality and view?
Yeah, I I'm one of six. So when you say you're competitive, you're one of six, you're competitive anyway.
Where were you in the lineup?
You have to be competitive, right? who gets to the table first, too, you know? Growing up with six kids is definitely an interesting social experiment.
Where were you in the lineup?
I'm number two.
Number two, okay. And you have an older sister or brother?
Older brother.
And what's your sign, Shannon?
I am a Capricorn. My birthday's on Sunday.
Oh, all right. Well, a advanced happy birthday to you.
Thank you. Thank you. So my dad, he was around a lot. He coached our sports teams. He would come home from work and talk about what he did for a living and really enjoyed his profession. And I think that feeds off on those that are listening. Four of the six of us are in the financial services space. Three of us are working in the firm.
Interesting. Okay. What kind of personality does your dad have? How would you describe him? I'd imagine he's an extrovert if he's in the business he's in.
You know what? I wouldn't say he's an extrovert.
No, okay.
He's a very kind, charismatic man, but not, I wouldn't say, an extrovert.
Interesting. How about you, Shannon? Do you consider yourself an extrovert, or where do you land on the scale?
I would think people would be surprised that I would say I'm an introvert.
How does that work in that profession? I guess you don't have to be an extrovert. When you sit down with a client, you're engaged and you're talking, but you're not a person who feels like they have to be talking throughout the day. Or when you come home to your husband and children, you don't necessarily start jabbering about what happened that day, I take it.
That's correct. And I get my, you know, most peace and satisfaction when I'm out on a run, often by myself.
Yeah, tell us about I remember you mentioned earlier that you run marathons. Obviously, that shows part of your competitive nature. But what about running attracts you? Because there are a lot of people who like athletics or they like exercise, but they really hate running. What does running do for you just in terms of, let's start with, obviously, physically, it fine-tunes the body. What does it do for you mentally or emotionally?
It's the one exercise I found, and I've done a lot of things through my life, it's the one exercise I found that really allows me to clear my mind. And I do my absolute best thinking when I'm on a run.
So let's say you're out there running, you're in the middle of your run, a great idea occurs to you, or just something you want to remember. Do you carry, do you have a recorder with you? Do you have a paper and pencil? What do you do in a case like that?
That's actually a really great question. I love that. So I will stop in the middle of a run if I'm not running with other people, and I carry my phone in my back pocket, and I will text myself. I do come up with, I could be, if I wasn't doing this, I would be a serial entrepreneur, because I come up with wacky ideas all the time.
Are you a long, slow distance runner, or do you tend to run shorter routes and higher speed?
I run anywhere between 6 and 10 miles a day.
Okay, interesting. So, and you've run several marathons. Have you run any of the big ones like Boston, New York, London?
Run Boston. Okay, so I just started running marathons 3 years ago, and I've run Boston, New York. I'm running London in April, and I ran Berlin.
Wow. Let me ask you about Boston, though. Did you start running Boston after the attack happened, the terror attack?
I did, but my sister, who runs our HR here, she was there during the bombing. She's also a runner, and I do run with her as well.
I assume she was uninjured by it.
She was. She's very, very, very fast, and she was done by about 40 minutes, I think, before that had happened.
Wow. Now, you are a member of the CNBC Financial Advisor Council, and I don't know what that is. What does that mean?
They select 20 and what they call high-level financial professionals. And the group contributes to guest columns as well as advice and insights on frontline perspectives that CNBC is looking for. Recently, somebody called on, you know, our thoughts on Bitcoin, or we'll get a call on, you know, thoughts on market valuation or what we're seeing going into the next year or various financial planning topics, and we'll contribute to those as we can and as they want.
Do you do on-air stuff as well, Shannon?
I have.
You have. Okay. So separate from CNBC, I'm curious, what subject, the whole private wealth advisory business, what subject do you feel especially strongly about or have the most passion for that you would choose as a topic or comes up most in conversation when people ask you about the business?
Well, let me answer that two ways, and then I don't think I'm going to answer your question, so you can ask me again if I don't hit what you're actually asking for. What I'm most passionate about in our business is education. So it doesn't matter what the subject matter is necessarily, but I think it's very important, and we're very dedicated as a firm to educating the next generation and to educating women. So two things there. I co-lecture a class at UC Irvine on wealth management, and really it's a class that we developed for the MBA program, but we now have taken that class and we teach it during a 10-week period over the summer for our summer interns. It's a intro into wealth management for individuals or institutions. And it's just to educate people, first of all, on the business of wealth management, because what I've found over the last 5 years of teaching is many people don't even know that it's a industry. I mean, they know of the big brokerage houses, they know of, you know, the investment banking, they know of the large banks, but they're not very familiar with the registered investment advisor. So that's the first thing. And then on the educating women, you know, we do a number of things in that regard. We have a Women's Advisory Institute, which is really geared towards putting on a couple events a year to make finance fun and make the topic interesting and get more women to the table. So, you know, we had a mixologist come in and talk about, you know, how to mix a great cocktail, but we also talked about, you know, how to mix up your portfolio allocation. Or we had a professional organizer come in and teach us about, you know, keeping things organized, and then we talked about organizing your, you know, financial future. You know, we did heart health and portfolio health. So we do that. We've done a Girl Scout badge for finance. Every year we teach the juniors in high school for National Charity League about finance, and what the topic with the presentation that we've called it is Straight into College, but really giving them tips on what they should be thinking about before they get to college and before they start making money and having debt or whatever that looks like. And it's really funny because I hear it all the time from moms. Oh my gosh, I'm working on getting my daughter a credit card so she can establish credit. So these girls are learning something that they're just not teaching in the high schools or, frankly, in the colleges. We took all this information, all this stuff that we've learned over the last many, many years, the main questions we get from clients, and we started something called Get the Sense. It's a weekly blog that is financial information, and it's written in a fun and relatable way. And it comes every Tuesday morning, and it's, you know, you name it, we've covered the topic. And we took that information that we've done over the last couple of years, and we just published a book last week. Oh. And or maybe 2 weeks ago, week or whatever. But it, as of today, it's an international bestseller, and it's not even in hard print yet, but it will be on Amazon, and we're very excited about it. And we really think it should get in the hands of everybody who gets the first paycheck.
What's the title of the book?
Your Dollars, Our Sense.
And the blog posts that get distributed each Tuesday, do you author those, or you and team members author those? Is that
authored? There's six of us, maybe seven. Six or seven of us in the office that author them, that have created the content, created the idea, created, you know, all the and co-authored the book.
Interesting. So one of the big challenges for your industry right now is attracting young, well, attracting financial planners at all, but particularly millennials. And a lot of them, it's interesting that you say a lot of them don't even realize it's a profession. And and those who do know it's a profession seem to not feel that it's got all that much sex appeal. What would you tell a young person if you had a young man or woman walk in your door and just say, you know, I'm thinking about this as a career, but can you tell me why it would make sense? I mean, what would you tell a young person who's thinking about being a financial advisor?
Yeah, well, let me first start off by saying that to a class we've taught over the last 5 years, somebody has changed careers and gotten into wealth management. I've hired two of them, but every class we get at least one person that says, hey, I'm moving careers because of what they've heard about the business. I think what I would tell a young person and what I do tell young people looking to get into the business, it's a great career for those who are looking to help others and have a broad knowledge of topics in the finance industry. So we are the quarterback for a client's, whether it's a private client or institution, we are the quarterback for their financial health and wealth.
Let's go back for a second to the mixologist. What was the age of the group were these school kids, like junior high school kids or high school?
No! I wouldn't bring a mixologist in for junior high school kids.
They were going to drink it. Only that you were going to explain.
Everyone was over 21. We have done, which is it's a great piece. Great pieces. We've done, and I think it was actually our largest attendance here at the office when we did that event. It was planning through the decades. So we did 20s, 30s, 40s, and 50s. And we actually did over 60s, but nobody in their 60s wanted to be in a room with over 60 people, so they went in other rooms. But we will go through, here are the key elements for planning, for you to organize your financial future in this particular decade.
Interesting. So you're very oriented on education and on the advancement of women.
Really just the advancement of everyone as it relates to understanding their financial health and wealth.
Before you started your own firm, Shannon, what would you count as some of your major accomplishments? Or don't even have to use the word major, just some of your accomplishments prior to starting your own firm, because obviously most people don't start a firm unless they've got a good deal of confidence in themselves, and you must have...
Or they're just not that smart and crazy. I don't know that I had... I mean, obviously I had my MBA. I only applied to UCLA. I was accepted into UCLA and decided that if I was going to go back to school, I wanted to go to, you know, a top university. And so at the time, I probably could have applied to USC too, but decided that I wanted to go to UCLA. I would say my biggest accomplishment was grit. And that just, you know, it's just the hard work and understanding that, making sure I understood what I didn't understand. And I didn't have all these awards or I didn't have any of that. It was just really more the tenacity and the knowledge that I knew I could make a difference with clients if we had the model set up appropriately. And at the time when we started the company, we were 2002. I just had my second child. He was born on January 15th. We started the company on March 14th.
So now you have four children. So that's a very busy schedule. And
but my husband is a stay-at-home dad, and he's been home for almost 19 years.
Oh wow! So okay, so you got a lot of help as far as that goes.
Thank God.
Yeah. Tell me about the company culture at Beacon Point. Well, how would you describe the culture there?
I would say a couple things. It's very entrepreneurial, meaning that no idea is a bad idea. And I love it when people say, hey, let's break this up and rethink this and let's try to do things, you know, maybe different, maybe better, or have you thought of, or have we thought of doing it this way? which I think having that type of culture also leads to a lot of respect, mutual respect with everyone.
Your firm talks about a futuristic point of view. Elaborate on that. What do you mean by a futuristic point of view?
Well, we're not just looking at today for a client's investments or their total portfolio. It's what is the business of investing their wealth look like 5, 10, and 15 years from now? So that we're planning for changes within the business. From a client's point of view, when I talk about planning and how important planning is for our clients, is we don't want to plan in a vacuum. We want to make sure that we're planning for what does their future look like? Does their future look like having children, having grandchildren? Is their dream to pay for their grandkids' education? Is it to make sure they're taking their family on a total family vacation with all the family members every year? So it's planning for the future as we plan for today with their investments and their portfolio construction.
Got it. Okay. Now, you have an outsourced CIO service. Tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, the outsourced CIO is really for the foundation and endowment client that's looking for a partner to help them do all things investment as it relates to their portfolio. And it really helps us develop a total strategy for them. You know, oftentimes on the institutional side of the business, which I'm sure you know, is that you sit in front of a board of, 5 to 10 people, go through their portfolio allocation. The board's very involved in that. Well, there are also many foundation endowments that would really like that outsourced. So we do everything from, helping them open the accounts to investing those accounts to trading those accounts to, reviewing everything as it relates to their financial picture.
So I notice your client base includes, and you referenced this earlier, faith-based organizations, and also Native American organizations. Is there a story behind how that came to pass?
It's a really good question, and I don't know that I actually have the answer to that, because that's really our institutional team that does that on the Native American side. I can tell you from working with Native American tribes, which I have done, and I actually did at Roxbury as well, it's a group of individuals that really benefit from our help. You look at any foundation is full of private clients that sit on the board, but Native American organizations, they're all private clients, right? So it's you're helping a bunch of private clients in one endowment or one corporation of assets. It's just a good fit for our organization in terms of what they're looking for and what we provide. We've done for one that I can think of, we've put together a 100-year sustainable financial plan for this particular tribe, which really goes to how do you educate their members, which many Native American organizations are about the education as well, but how do you educate their members about their fiduciary responsibilities for financial success in the future? They're also, very, very in tune with having a sustainable investment policy for generations to come.
Is there a particular, when it comes to impact investing or socially responsible investing, what's the number one category? Is it education? Is it alleviating poverty? Is it the arts, environment? Where do you see most of the money and passion going?
I would say today, where we see most of it going is to the environment. But that's not to say it's just going to the environment for impact investing. We see it across the board, but that is, I would say, that's the greatest area that we see. But it does go across everything that you just mentioned.
Let's talk about your individual clients for a moment, your typical individual or family. What is the biggest issue you see when they walk through the door? What is a common issue that you need to solve when they come through the door?
I would say for a private client, it's really the organization and understanding of their total financial picture. And it's not that they don't necessarily understand their wealth, but it's really taking that deep dive to understand all their assets and liabilities and how they want to use those assets and liabilities to fulfill their mission or their purpose with their those bunnies. I think it just allows them to look at things a little bit differently.
You know, one of the things I've certainly learned over the years, Shannon, is that diversification is not, there's a lot of different views on what constitutes diversification of a person's or family's portfolio, an investment portfolio. How do you define a properly diversified investment portfolio?
One that meets the client's end goals.
No, you're the first person to give me that particular answer. Interesting.
Well, I mean, so I look at it like this. So client comes in the door, has got, you know, investable assets of, you know, X dollars. Can you achieve what they're looking to achieve? And it doesn't matter. It truly doesn't matter how well diversified they are. It's, are they appropriately diversified for what they're trying to achieve? Because you can have a municipal bond portfolio that absolutely achieves the client's long-term goals. You may not be able to get a lot of growth out of that portfolio over the long term, but that may not be what that client's looking to achieve. So it really is specific to the client. I mean, yes, we diversify portfolios. Yes, we have various, you know, asset classes, you know, private equity, alternatives, all that. But it really is so dependent upon the individual, what they're looking to do with their investments.
How do you guys go about constructing portfolios? Is there, what's the methodology?
Well, we have a number of software systems that we use for developing the asset allocation, but it really comes from, it's really a bottoms-up approach, is what is the client trying to achieve with their assets? And then we build the portfolio. It's not the other way around. We don't say, here are the five portfolios we have. Let's make a client fit into one of these portfolios. You know, we look at, I mean, important characteristics, and this is nothing that you haven't heard from somebody else before, but we assess what does that risk tolerance look like? You know, can they weather a downturn in the market, and what does that look like with the overall portfolio? What are their life goals, but what also are their legacy goals? What are their, you know, life and their legacy goals?
So are you guys active or passive investors?
So we have a bias towards active investment, but our bias is really towards, and I'm sure you know, active share. Our bias is towards managers that have a high active share, so that aren't looking like an index. But we do use passive strategies for exposure to efficient U.S. equity classes, and, you know, we active strategies could be used for, you know, various other asset classes. It really just depends. It depends on two things. It depends on, you know, what the client's looking to achieve, but also it depends on how efficient that particular asset class is.
Now, you do have a four-step investment process. So walk us through the steps just briefly.
We came up with this just to make it understandable to clients. So it's called open, and it's objective. So really providing our clients with an objective point of view as it comes to, as it relates to their assets. So prudent investing. So what's the best way to invest these assets? If you have your life goals, do we have a portfolio with your life goal assets? And then you've got legacy goals. Do we have a different portfolio to meet those particular needs? And we do that oftentimes with private clients. Have a here's your life goals, and here's what you're trying to achieve with this particular portfolio, but you've got legacy goals. You've got the unique opportunity to be doing some different things with your other portfolio. And we have E is for experienced. Yeah, we've got a number of CFPs. We have CFAs. We've got a certified divorce specialist. We've got, you know, attorneys on staff, CPAs, a number of CFAs. And I've said this probably four times different ways, but it's really based on needs. So it's what is this particular client's need? And can we help this client based on what they're trying to achieve with their portfolio?
When it comes to the individuals and families, do you deal with alternatives and real assets? Does the endowment model influence at all some of the work that you do there?
We understand the endowment model. We've looked to the endowment model. We do use real assets and alternative assets as absolutely a part of our client portfolio, so very important, depending upon, obviously, the individual client need or the institution need. You know, obviously, if there's any liquidity issues or anything like that, some alternatives may not play a role in the portfolio, but absolutely, that's part of our overall strategy. And remember, our coming from the institutional world, the expectation is to have that type of portfolio. So that we grew up on that model, and we've been able to take that model for many years to our private clients, which has been very beneficial.
Now, my understanding is that you and your team keep a running list of mistakes made by the financial industry. Those made by members of your firm, as well as those that are made by your competitors. Interesting idea. Where did that idea come from?
Well, I don't know where we came up with it, but we came up with it many, many, many years ago. And it's really not to get complacent in this market environment, because you in any market environment, everyone says it's different this time. It's usually not different this time. There's usually something else underlying the economy that will cause the economy to have a downturn in the market again, and we will have some reversion of the means. We just want to be aware of things that have come into play that may either not be good investment decisions, may help us as we are analyzing investment managers, what mistakes have been made. You know, we look at, and as easy it is to look at this in hindsight, but we look at somebody like a Bernie Madoff or, you know, other issues like that, and we say, what happened? How did that firm get to the door at some pretty decent-sized investment firms? And we want to make sure that we're not making those mistakes. And knock on wood, we haven't. And we've actually seen, I mean, we've had folks at the door, you know, that obviously want to get on our platform because we've got assets, but they won't get through our process because our process is, our questionnaire is a 10-page questionnaire, and we make every investment manager sit across the table from us and go through absolutely everything about their business. And then we're on-site visiting and asking questions that, we had an investment manager tell us that getting on our recommended list was like getting a colonoscopy. He's like, it was a painful process, and he said it took him 2 years to get on our investment platform because no other advisory firm asks as many questions.
Do you think you learn more from mistakes than you do from successes?
No question.
How about the global financial crisis? Actually, you kind of addressed this earlier. I wanted to ask about what the experience was like for Beacon Point during the global financial crisis. What impact did it have on your operations?
Yeah, I mean, obviously that time period forced everyone to look deeply at their operations, and we weren't immune to that. We did the same, but we were fortunate enough that we recognized that was a very big opportunity for us, and we actually hired into that. As we were coming out of that crisis, we were fortunate in that we were able to retain and get some good talent there, and we also were able to grow our business quite a bit because clients liked the fact that we were paying attention to downside protection. I mean, the best calls I made during that period were clients who said, "Gosh, I've been watching CNBC and I opened my statement, and I was crying. I was so happy that my portfolio had done so well." You know, their expectation was that everything had gone out the door.
Describe your management style, I mean internally, with your people. What kind of management style do you bring to your fellow partners and staff members?
So, I think I lead by example is first and foremost. And I hired, I believe... And I say we hire really good people. We don't micromanage. And we lead as a team. I do a monthly leadership meeting with all the leaders of the firm so that we're all on the same page, driving for the same goals and vision of the firm to help our clients.
Now, I'm assuming that the firm is in growth mode right now. And if that is the case, where do you see most of your growth coming from?
Most of our growth is coming from our twofold. Client referrals, existing client referrals, and our partner offices.
By adding partner offices?
Correct. And the partner office is growing very well.
You'd find an office, there's partners there, they're looking to realize some financial gain for all the hard work that they've done. They have access to the resources that you have available at Beacon Point, but they're kind of a somewhat independent operation. Obviously, why don't you describe it to me? Is it along those lines, and what kind of autonomy do they have?
Independent to a degree. I mean, they're running their businesses on a day-to-day basis, but in collaboration with us. Right, so now they have an investment platform that they can utilize, the same investment platform. They have the same contact management system. They have the same marketing. They've got the same social media. They've got, they're just able to leverage off a platform that they otherwise wouldn't have, being the original size they were when they joined us.
You have a lot going on there. So when I think in terms of like 5 to 10 years, you look down the road 5, 10 years, where do you want to take the firm? Do you have maybe you have some initiatives that are in incubation right now? I don't know. But where do you see the firm in 5 or 10 years?
Well, I want to make sure that we're on the forefront of technology. So I want to make sure that our firm has the technology to allow clients to do things the way clients want to do things for this next generation. You know, a lot of things are done online versus where they weren't 10 or 15 years ago. You know, a lot of portfolio mechanics, we look at the robo-advisory platform. If I want to make sure that we're delivering the highest technology experience we can for clients while still keeping it personal, I don't think you can have simply a electronic client investment solution without the personal touch, because so much of somebody's financial pieces are intertwined, and you need a human in there to have the conversation about, what are those goals that are important to those clients. And the other thing that we would like to see in our business is, you said continued growth. Yes, of course, continued growth. We're looking to expand our partner offices, double those partner offices in the next 2 to 5 years. And there's a lot of opportunity out there to do that.
How are you finding them? I mean, what's your criteria?
They're finding us, and we're finding them. Obviously, we know who the players are out there. I think I've sat on Schwab's advisory board. One of my partners sat on TD's advisory board, as well as Fidelity's. So we're out there in the industry quite a bit. And I think we've built a pretty good name for ourselves. We have a good reputation in the community, and I think people are looking to do business with good people.
So what would your criteria be? You might have somebody who shows up and says, I'd like to become a partner firm, but you don't just take all comers, do you?
We do not. First and foremost, we want to make sure it's the right cultural fit. We want to work with good people. And it's not the almighty dollar. It's we're working with these people day in and day out. We want to make sure we're building a great team with great people.
Now, is there a professional experience you've had, Shannon, that stands out as one that helped make you who you are as a professional?
I think what's telling about who I am, and maybe this tells a little story of who I am, is, in 2002 when we formed the firm, we didn't have any clients. We didn't have any assets. We had 8 employees. We had a credit line. I sold my house. I just had child number 2. And I believed that it would work. And I think if you have the belief that you've got something that's special and that can help people, and you do right by clients, I think the sky's the limit.
How many hours a week do you work?
I'm always working, right? I mean,
you don't really know when it begins and ends. It's just kind of
how many hours a night do you sleep? Because other than that, I'm actually working on the business or working. You know, it's either in the business or on the business or thinking about, you know, how can we be doing things a little bit better or differently? How do we serve our clients better? I mean, I do have clients that text me, you know, at night about, you know, or probably shouldn't print that either because it's probably not SEC compliant. But that you know, that are looking to get a hold of me on the weekend, and that's I'm available to clients. I'm available to our staff as well. So, I probably am in the office 50 hours a week, but I'm working